This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to Jordan's last episode of Slate Money. That's Jordan opening a bottle of Prosecco to celebrate. He finally gets out of this podcasting studio. He's going glug, glug, glug.
He is
drinking Prosecco because he's a bit déclassé. I'm drinking a fine natural wine from New Zealand. With a bit of like time on the skins. Anna's not drinking at all because she doesn't drink.
Dan's got some of the Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand too.
We have some fine Lebanese white here. We are celebrating the end of an era. This is our 200th episode. We're excited about that. This is the final episode featuring Mr. Jordan Weissman, although I still suspect that somewhere and somehow we're going to drag him back on this show.
Yeah, I'll probably be back at some point.
If Kathy O'Neill can come back, you can come back.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like
it's a lot more. It's a bigger schlep for her. It takes you about 2 minutes to walk over here.
It is, and knowing how we do guest booking on this show, I feel like
15 minutes before the show. Hey,
Jordan, can you just
like next time when Yanis Varoufakis just gives up halfway through and says, "You know what? I'm not coming on after." After all, we'll just say, that's okay, we'll get Jordan on instead.
Yeah, it would be great. I mean, and you know, I've shown up in the middle of episodes anyway, too. So if you just need to brighten one up, I'm happy to reprise
exactly,
that. There are all sorts of things.
You know, instead of having, the Slate IT person come in and do a Slate Plus segment, we can get Jordan to come in. Anyway, we are going to answer... Well, no, we are not going to answer anything. Jordan is going to answer your questions.
This is going to be a team effort, as usual. But yeah, these questions are directed at me. You guys wrote in with some lovely inquiries, a lot of callbacks to former segments on the show, or throwaway lines of mine about New Year's resolutions.
And so, yeah, so this is going to be the last Felix, Sam, and Jordan Weissman, Anna Szymanski show for a while.
Yeah.
Enjoy it while it lasts, and let's get... straight into it.
I'm going to pour... So Felix brought this Lebanese wine with... So I said I'm going to bring Prosecco to celebrate. And Felix is like, I'll bring wine. And then he literally shows up with... This is very sweet. This like Lebanese wine from one of the world's oldest vineyards. It's half drunk, but still, that's not a bad thing in wine world. That just means it may have... I just
breaking
broke
the cork.
All right, I'm going to go for the Kiwi Sauvignon Blanc as well.
That doesn't taste like Sauvignon.
Dan, find the corkscrew.
The cork is a disaster. All right.
Like, honestly, like we need to work on Jordan Weissman's cork extraction technique. Let's start with a wonky thing, and then we are going to get into stupider things.
Yeah, we're going
like
to go
McDonald's
wonky, stupid,
and,
wonky.
And
yeah.
Swell thing. I want to ask you about housing because this is the one thing that we talk about off air more than anything else. It's basically your misadventures in the Brooklyn real estate market. So
yes.
We are going to talk a little bit about that on air as well. We have some housing related questions. But yeah, let's actually talk about universal basic income because we were going to have Chris Hughes on this show.
We were considering it.
We invited him to come on the show.
Yeah.
And
then you wrote a review of his book.
And then I wrote a review of his book.
Which actually I thought was a fairly kind review.
Yeah,
it wasn't a completely excoriating review, but for whatever reason, Chris Hughes, after reading that review, has gone quite quiet. And I'm going to assume at this point that he is not coming on this show, which is okay because Annie Lowry has a book coming out on universal basic income. And so when that comes out, we will talk to her instead.
That's the book everyone actually was waiting for about universal basic income.
And I started reading that one. And so we will talk to her in great depth about universal basic income. But
so someone
in
asked
the meantime,
yeah.
We have a voicemail.
Yeah.
Dan, can you play us the voicemail?
Hi, yeah, this is a question for Jordan. My question is about basic income. Basically, if everybody were to get the same amount of money around the country, or at least a starter, every person that doesn't have much money, would it get the same amount of money? Wouldn't that just raise prices for everything? And what would then happen? What would be the point of that? How would that solve anything if all of a sudden rents are going up, food's going up? If that is actually the outcome. So yeah, that's the question. What happens? What's the economics of if everybody actually gets the same amount of money? What happens to the price of goods? Doesn't that just rise?
Does UBI cause inflation?
So this is like kind of a brain teaser, right? But it shouldn't in any. So it depends like how you'd implement it, right? Like in theory, if the government just printed money and handed it out to everybody, you'd expect some amount of inflation, right? It's just like in the end, you're just adding money to the system and you're going to push up some goods, some amount, probably not one for one to the point where you're like, you know, just because food stamps go up doesn't mean the cost of food goes up exactly proportionately, but you'd expect prices to rise. To some degree.
You would. I mean, normally fiscal stimulus, that's somewhat of the point.
Yeah, is
that
exactly.
You're trying. Now, we have seen that we've actually had a hard time creating inflation.
But UBI is not the same as fiscal stimulus. And if you fund it with tax hikes or even if you just borrow the money, then that shouldn't necessarily...
You kind of have to think about it. If you... do tax hikes, then it's just redistribution, in which case there may be actually no increase in the total money supply, right?
Inflation is not entirely a monetary phenomenon.
No, exactly. We don't know what causes inflation.
Let's do something like a basic, like the intuition here. Intuition behind the question is, if poor people get more money, then the things that poor people buy, like, you know, staple foods and rents on manufactured housing and that kind of thing, are likely to rise because there's going to be more money in the poor population. And I think to a certain degree, that's probably true, that even if you're paying for it with tax hikes on the rich, you're going to see a certain amount of price rises for the people who are receiving the money. But I think you're also absolutely right that the amount of money they get will vastly outweigh the effect of inflation.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you have to ask, where's the equilibrium, right? Like, okay, people get more money, prices rise a little bit, but on net, are they still better off? And you have to remember, certain products they're buying aren't going to be based on... Like, I think it's helpful to think about these things geographically, right? Like, you're going to be dumping money on poor communities, essentially. And so you'd probably expect something like housing to go up a bit because that's so geographically focused. But food... Food, right? Like that's so much of food costs are nationalized and globalized. So you don't expect the effect to be even.
If someone decided to raise prices on their bread or whatever, then someone else would come in with cheaper bread. And you would still, the same forces keeping prices down right now, which is basically Walmart, will continue to keep prices down. It's not like Walmart will suddenly take the opportunity to raise prices, because what Walmart does is always try and keep prices as low as possible.
Yeah. So if we were to kind of summarize this, I'd say if you just do it as redistribution, you might not get any inflation at all nationally, which is typically what we care about, although you might see prices rise on some things in some communities. If you just dump money on the country and borrow it, you'll probably see some inflation. But as we know, it's very hard to create.
Even when we really try.
Make prices rise and we really try hard, and for reasons that no one is totally sure of. And even if they do rise, they're not going to rise on everything evenly, because thank you, China.
Yes.
And I have one more inflation question for you.
Sure.
Which is, why is it that we are still so scared of inflation when we haven't had it for decades?
Because that's exactly why people are so scared, because of the 70s, right? Like the people in power or decision makers came of age during stagflation and they were scarred by it for 30 something years. And so there's just this idea that you not only have to stick to an inflation, you not only need a low inflation target, you can't even budge from it, because then that will make people doubt your dedication to sticking to this inflation target. Sorry, I'm about to start ranting.
It's also like inflation is a bit of a psychological issue as well. Once you create the idea that there is inflation, that can create more inflation. Also,
Well, give me an example of that, like in the past 30 years.
So I think one of the concerns is that if you have an inflation spike that you really didn't expect and you have to hike up interest rates really quickly, you're more likely to push the economy into recession, as opposed to if you just have kind of managed, expected, slow hikes, you're going to have less of a negative impact on the economy.
Yeah, I think that's true. I will put out a prediction, though. I think that when millennials eventually are actually like monetary policy decision makers, we're going to be very, very lax about inflation because we've
never had it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, can I just say as a Gen Xer,
yeah,
and a large chunk of the economic decision making apparatus is now my generation.
Yeah.
Like, I don't remember inflation either.
No, but there's just enough of you who came up right after, like, who were kind of in their, like, intellectually formative years in the Reagan era after Volcker had just slayed inflation, and that was seen as sort of the triumph of modern monetary policy. And so that was just sort of the religion, right? Like, that is sort of, I mean, you could really say, like, the era of economics we are, monetary economics we're in, started in the Carter era with stagflation, and then Paul Volcker came and showed how you end stagflation as far as everyone was concerned, and that became that became our religion. So there's still a lot of Gen Xers who are baptized in that religion, whereas millennials have been sitting around, all of us who are interested in economic policy have been sitting around thinking, like, we have a demand issue. We've been dealing with subpar aggregate demand for a decade, basically, and we may actually still not be quite back to where we need to be, even though everyone's talking about a tight economy.
Okay, so I'm not quite sure how much that had to do with universal basic income, but we will have Annie Lowrey on if she will come on. I'm hoping that she will be more willing to come on than Chris Hughes was.
I think she will be.
I think she will be.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Okay, next.
Should we get stupid?
Okay, let's get stupid. Jordan.
Yeah.
We have a combo question here.
Yes.
One from Pete is, what is your status on getting swole? The second one from Greg Young is, have you recanted? Do you still defend McDonald's? Or are you still intellectually maturing? And then the third one is, do you recommend giving up sugar for weight loss? And does it only work if you give up alcohol? All of these are connected.
They are all connected.
So let's start with the obvious one, which is, how much McDonald's are you eating these days?
Okay. I had an egg white delight like 2 days ago.
Egg white delight?
Yes.
Is that a thing?
They are a delight. But I'm going to come to McDonald's last, okay? I'm going to start with getting swole. So this, for really attentive listeners,
was a resolution.
We all talked about New Year's resolution, and I said my resolution was to get swole, which meant like putting on some just not like tiny bit amount of muscle, because I'm built like a, you know, pile of pizza dough or something. That never really happened. I did not get swole.
Wasn't your grandfather a boxer?
My grandfather was very much a boxer. His name was Nady the New Deal Brown. He fought Joe Louis twice, got his ass kicked both times, though he claims he took a fall the second. I doubt that was true. Although he also was mixed up in the mob. He went to jail for assisting in a bank robbery at one point. So I don't know. Who knows? Maybe he took the fall. So you'd think genetically I'd have some ability to put on muscle, but I still haven't unlocked it, if that's true. What I did do...
Did you try lifting weights?
I have. But so what I did instead was I lost about 25 pounds. So that is the...
You just like woke up one morning and said, I can't find my 25 pounds, so they down the back of the sofa.
It's been like about 9 months of fairly hard work. But so I'm going to try to put this in economic terms, but also while also talking about alcohol and talking about McDonald's. So let's start with like three things I think I've basically done. Number one is I used to have a morning bacon, egg, and cheese habit, which was,
shockingly.
Felix is giving me this look.
I'm all in favor of a morning bacon, egg, and cheese. Like I thoroughly approve.
It turns out if you stop eating bacon, eggs, and cheese on a regular basis, it's easy to take off some weight. One of the things I've replaced that with is the McDonald's Egg White Delight, which is about 290 calories and is a perfect breakfast food.
So I'm going to point out that I think that's more about portion control about the bacon, egg, and cheese.
So wait, what, first of all, because I am a ignorant man who never goes to McDonald's, what is an Egg White Delight?
It is, you know, an Egg McMuffin?
Vaguely.
Okay, well, okay. An Egg McMuffin is like one of the great national dishes of the United States of America. But it's just like, you know...
So wait, you're doing that only with egg whites?
So the Egg White Delight is a Egg McMuffin. So it's, you know, a little Canadian bacon, an English muffin, and eggs, but it's just the egg whites. So it's like a little... And cheese. And a little,
I'm going to not endorse that.
So wait, it is a bacon, egg, and cheese. It just doesn't have egg yolks.
But it's 290 calories as opposed to the, convenience store special in Manhattan, which is just this sloppy, monster, delicious, gooey thing.
But it's also probably much larger, whereas the one thing that McDonald's does is that they...
Small.
Exactly. Well, it's standardized. And so...
Standardization. Exactly.
That's exactly what it is, because actually the yolks are not bad for you. I'm going to push back on it. Actually are much more nutritious than just egg whites, but...
I'm a big fan of egg yolks.
Not the way they cook them at McDonald's, though. So a lot of these fast food restaurants have made this horrible mistake, in my opinion, where to kind of latch on to...
Including McDonald's?
Yeah.
Are you going to hate on McDonald's?
Yeah, so they've all latched onto like the kind of freshness trend, like it needs to be wholesome. And so they've started cooking whole eggs, and they just sort of boil them until they're hardened in the yolk. And so you just get this ugly, gritty, not very good yolk in the middle of your McMuffin. And so that's, you're better off, in my opinion, with just getting the egg whites, because it's just, you don't want an improperly cooked whole egg. It's not good. You get a rubbery white and a chalky yolk.
Can I just jump in here to give
Are you going to plug your sous vide machine right now?
My absolutely foolproof hard-boiled egg recipe for the best hard-boiled eggs you've ever had. Mm-hmm. Cook them at 183 degrees for 10 minutes. Take them out of the water, put them into the egg carton, and just let them slowly cool down to room temperature in the egg carton. And then once they've done that, it's perfect. The whites are solidified, but not rubbery. The yolks are, I like to say it's the texture of Marmite. They've got a nice little texture to them. They're beautiful.
Oh, man.
A reference all of our American audience.
You know, we've got enough international listeners that I doubt that went over too many people's heads. But okay, so that's kind of switching to a more standardized breakfast. I would say the Egg White Delight is not my everyday. Actually, I eat a lot of yogurt. I have like a 1 cup of Fache yogurt.
Is it sweetened or unsweetened?
I add a teaspoon of honey and half a handful of almonds, which is about 20 almonds. So a lot of it is about standardization.
Oh my God, you're doing the whole like Barack Obama counting your almonds thing.
Well, I know roughly what fits into the palm of my left hand, but when I count it out, it's about 20, 25. Anyway, so that's part one. Part two was, I can actually sort of thank Felix for this, I think, which is I used to be very much a beer drinker. I was a beer guy. You all know there was the beer episode. I think after the Bianca Bosker cork dork episode, I finally decided I was going to fucking learn about wine. It was just going to happen. And that had a really helpful side effect, which is at first I thought I was just going to end up drinking more, but it turned out actually I just replaced most of my beer consumption with wine consumption. And wine is dry, right? Like there is just less carbs, less sugar in it for the most part because it gets turned into alcohol. And so that actually ended up being, when you read like these, you know, diet guru books or whatever, they say, oh, alcohol is like the devil. I think you can make a lot of progress if you just switch from like, you know, your Budweiser or your like, your Belgian triple or whatever the heck I was drinking to,
beer,
you know.
The wine substitution diet.
Yeah, to a lovely Pinot.
It works. Beer is liquid bread and wine is liquid grapes. And intuitively, bread is more fattening than grapes are.
Yes. And, you know, especially if you're into slightly lower alcohol, like reds or whites, you know, I've been drinking a lot of Pinot recently in like the 12% range. So that's cutting alcohol calories as well. So I guess part two, it's like the Michael Pollan formulation maybe, or a paraphrase, like drink wine, not too much, mostly Pinot. And then part three is about commitment devices, which is I just joined a stupidly expensive gym. I am now a bad bitch up in Equinox, as Kanye might put it. And while it hurts me every time I look at my credit card statement, it has shamed me into going to the gym regularly.
Wait, and so if you go to the gym regularly, does that not make you swole?
I do a lot of cardio and Pilates.
Pilates?
Well, I have my bum back, and so it's wonderful for your core.
They have good Pilates classes at that Equinox.
They do. So. I have my favorites. Thanks, Dara.
And does Pilates help you lose weight?
Not really. It does help with, but again, if you're hunched over a bike a lot, which I am, it's good to then.
You go biking a lot? Is that the other
thing? No, I'm like on a spin machine kind of thing. So if you're hunched over a lot, it's good to then do a lot of stretching and work on your back and core.
And exercise doesn't really make you lose weight. Exercise is good for other things in terms of overall.
So I really.
It
depends on how much
you do. It's very limited.
I mean, if you do if you're on a bike for 45 minutes to an hour on, three times a week, that's going to help you some, right? Like just the sheer amount of calories. It's not going to do it alone, but it's going to help. You also have to switch from beer to wine.
Right. But it's far less than people think.
Okay.
Actually, I love exercise. It's great for me.
Okay.
To get back to McDonald's. So for listeners who've been with us a while, Kathy, Felix, and I had an episode where we each had, for Thanksgiving, where we each had to talk about one company that we were thankful for. And Felix, what did you pick again? Do you remember? I can't remember what Kathy picked. I picked McDonald's. And this became a two-episode argument. I think it was like I'd set off a bomb in the middle of Slate Money. And, you know, my argument boiled down to the fact that McDonald's had sort of brought a certain standardization of what the baseline quality of food in America should be when you're on the road, when you're in the middle of nowhere.
When you're in Brooklyn, apparently, you have an egg white delight.
Yeah, and it's sort of, exactly. And so in some places, it also just kind of guaranteed a nice, clean space where people could meet, which is actually important to having communities when you're in these far-flung suburbs and exurbs, that I was sort of, they had also sort of figured out the franchise model, which was an important development in American capitalism, even though they weren't necessarily the first to franchise anything.
Jordan, you're just repeating yourself.
Yeah,
a whole episode.
Well, so now here's, I've thought about this question because I saw it ahead of time. And I guess part of the issue is, can you be thankful for McDonald's if you also know that it's contributed to things like global warming because of how it's kind of helped increase American beef consumption and factory farming? And can you really be thankful for it if you know that the franchise model, that it played such an important role in popularizing, also has been probably horrible for workers? It's made it a lot harder to unionize because you're not part of one big company. And so the question is McDonald's responsible for these aspects of American capitalism, or would it have happened anyway without McDonald's? Were they just the ones to sort of carry it out? And so can you appreciate the good things and just blame the rest on the logic of, capitalism itself and kind of separate the two? Or is it all just so intertwined that McDonald's is capitalism? I think maybe that's the answer. And so maybe I should have more mixed feelings, because can you really say you're thankful for McDonald's in a sort of unqualified way without saying you're thankful for capitalism in an unqualified way? I don't know. So I don't recant. I'm going to complicate my answer, but I'm not going to recant fully because I still like their breakfast.
I'm not even going to fight back on that one because
I actually kind of agree with you.
Thank you.
I actually think
McDonald's
the history
is
of McDonald's, there are some positive things. Yeah. And I, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I do not even need to respond, because all of my responses are in prior episodes, and we have covered this already.
Also, one quick thing, yeah. I will say, as a child of like the 90s, who I had three sisters, and when you were a little kid, my parents took us to McDonald's quite frequently, and a lot of parents did, and our health was perfectly fine. And for parents, it was an inexpensive, easy way to sometimes feed their children when both parents were working long hours. And I think there was a benefit to that.
Yeah. I do sort of wonder if McDonald's hadn't come along, if actually you would have had something like Chipotle earlier, because in a lot of regions of America, that sort of, steam tray, lunch tray approach was normal. You know, in the Deep South, you have the meat and threes and such. And obviously you had Howard Johnson's and sit down places that were taking over the American roadside. But I do wonder if maybe, fast casual actually would have been would have conquered America if, although fast casual doesn't work as well for cars, and that's what it boils down to.
Right, and I think that's a big part of it too. The story of McDonald's is also the story of cars. Yeah.
And can you be thankful for McDonald's if you have mixed feelings about American transportation?
And
habits?
I hate cars. So.
So yeah, okay. Anyway, moving on.
I'm just
on.
Confused.
Moving on to the next question.
Let's move on to the next question.
Also, Felix, this Utah wine is lovely. I've shot. I still wish I hadn't broken the cork on the 1,000-year-old Lebanese wine or whatever, but this is good.
Okay.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now: getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Let's move on to housing. We have Rob in Toronto asking whether housing speculation is a good thing, whether it should be regulated. Should we stop people trying to flip houses to buy houses just because they think they're going to go up in value? Should we stop thinking of housing as an asset class? And related to this, the question which I wanted to ask a couple of weeks ago but didn't, what do you make of this factoid, which has now been circulating for a while and I think might even be true, that 35% of millennials don't even look at their house before they buy it?
I don't believe it, but like, I'm going to treat that factoid as true. Right, just for the sake of argument. So, which part should we talk about first?
I think it's related, right?
So you think many millennials are just speculating, that 35% of them are just deploying capital?
I don't think so.
That seems unlikely to me. That's a really high percentage.
Yeah, and I still wonder.
But I think the part of the logic there is that if what you're doing is buying some kind of an asset, then the market and the housing is your house is going to go up or not go up in value more or less regardless of what it looks like.
Yeah.
And so you don't need to care about what it looks like. But if you're thinking about it as an asset rather than if you're thinking about it as a place where you want to live.
So I'm going to assume, because I don't trust this survey entirely, but I'm going to assume that what it shows is that there are at least a few millennials out there who bought a house to live in without seeing it, that they just decided the internet was enough. And so it's not even necessarily that they are thinking of it entirely as an asset, although they might be saying, okay, this is my starter home, so it's only going to be a few years. I think this just like gets to sort of a general absurdity about the way we buy houses in this country, or just the fact, or really about home ownership in general. When Felix says we've talked a lot off air about my adventures in Brooklyn real estate, it's because I bought a co-op a while ago. And then I spent about a year with a hole in my bathroom ceiling that water would shower down on me from, thanks to my upstairs neighbors. There was litigation involved. Anyway, it's a long, long, colorful rant. My ceiling has finally been fixed. Everything seems to be fine. But the fact is, like, you don't really get to look at your home before, or you don't get to test drive your house. You get to test drive a car, but you get to basically visit your house a couple of times before you make an offer at most. And then maybe do one last walkthrough to make sure after an inspection to make sure that everything essentially is in working order. But you don't get to like stay there overnight usually to make sure that, oh, the neighbors upstairs aren't making an unholy racket regularly, or that your downstairs neighbors doesn't like, you know, blast the Rolling Stones at some unholy volume anyway. But these are things that you would think with a long-term purchase you'd get to do, but you do not. And so I wonder if there's just like some millennials who are thinking, well, what am I really actually going to get out of even visiting? I've heard some people I've talked about this with some people, and they've said they've started Airbnb-ing places for like one or two nights in order to test them out.
That's actually kind of smart.
Yeah, which I think is interesting. And maybe that, I don't know how widespread that would ever become, but in a housing market where you don't have, where people aren't just kind of racing to outbid each other, like in Brooklyn or you know, Manhattan, although Manhattan's kind of calming down, but I could see that actually becoming a little bit more widespread, that maybe that could become a standard part of the process. That would actually be very nice, I think. So I you know, if some millennials are just buying, you know, real estate sight unseen to live in because they think they're going to live in it for like 3-4 years at most and then move on like they would a rental, I don't know. It's sort of, I think it's sort of acknowledging the absurdity of the whole
Yeah, I mean, I actually know a number of people who have bought sight unseen, and it's often been because they had a relative or someone in the area who went and saw it before them.
Yeah.
And I do think what you said is really important, is that I know, like, when I bought my apartment, before I made the offer, I think I saw my apartment for like 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Because in New York, you have to make offers really quickly or you're not going to get the place.
Within 15 minutes?
No, but I probably only spent about 15 minutes in the apartment, and then...
There are only so many times you can walk around 800 square feet.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's like, okay, I've done the circuit again. Kitchen looks the same.
Right. It's more like, okay. And then, and also we do have a process of inspections to, and that's how the real estate market has always worked. I think it's less weird than it sounds. Also, it's only sight unseen before you make a bid. It doesn't mean that before the actual process is completely done and signed, you haven't seen it.
Yeah, that's true. Before, you may have put up like a security, you know, or
right,
something. But okay, so let's get to housing speculation now.
So, okay, so do you consider your co-op to be an asset?
Yeah, I consider it an asset. I consider it a savings vehicle. I don't necessarily consider it like... I mean, yeah, it's an asset. It's a thing that I own that I could sell and, you know, for money. Like, that's, and it's not, and it's not depreciating. It's not like a car where every mile I drive on it, every minute I live in it doesn't make the thing less valuable. So,
but you do worry. I mean, like, one of the things that, one of the sort of running themes that we had during the whole tax reform years, or it felt like years anyway, was your worry that the value of your co-op would decline were this tax reform to go through. And it seemed, at least at the time to me, to be that you felt that a decline in the value of your co-op would be a bad thing.
Yeah, well, for I think for most middle-class families that treat their real estate as their main savings vehicle, that's... Yeah, that is their asset. I mean, that's the reality. It's a question. There are two separate questions. Should it be an asset? And, you know, should houses be assets? And are they assets?
Yes.
Should
they be? Why wouldn't they be?
Yeah, I mean, like if you engineer Germany, you don't have to worry so much about it. If everyone's a renter, then, yeah, people find other ways to save. But in the U.S., you know, home equity's it. That's where the middle class puts their money. And so that is one of the things I really did worry about with tax reform, and we'll see how it plays out, whether or not people in sort of the, let's say, middle 60% would end up seeing some of their savings disappear for a tax cut that wouldn't pay off for a very, very long time compared to the amount that they would lose off their homes. But I guess coming back to the speculation thing, right? So I think I see where you're going. Whereas if you think of housing as an asset, then speculation should be fine, because speculation is really just a way of doing price discovery in a functioning market. And that's why, you know, when you hear about like oil, people blaming oil speculators for prices going up, it's like, well, also speculators manage to bring oil prices down. Yeah, exactly. It's just how you actually get...
You have speculators and hedgers. That's
how markets function. So should you, if housing is an asset, should you allow speculators? I think the problem is that housing isn't necessarily a functional market all the time, because you can't, like, you know, supply doesn't necessarily go up. As more speculators go in there, you might be constrained by zoning, you know, rules and whatnot. And this question came to us from someone in Toronto, where they just have tons and tons of Chinese money flowing in. So
but they do have inflows of people, even if they're not Chinese.
Yes.
And they can't build fast enough to accommodate all those people, and you do have a sort of systemic demand outpacing supply problem in Toronto, and that has made not only property prices extremely high in Toronto, but it has also broken the market in a weird way, to the point at which it becomes actually very, very difficult to buy anything at all.
Yeah, and this is, you know, I think the big question here in the end is with something like housing that is socially essential, right? That you have to have people need to be able to live in a city. Should it just be completely dictated by the rules of the market, right? Should it be treated just like any other asset? And you can come back to this with healthcare, right? Should healthcare just run by market rules? And you know, I think the answer is no, not entirely. You need to have, you can't treat it as a pure asset the way you like would a bond or a stock, and you have to regulate and figure out how you're going to make it possible for middle class and lower income people to survive.
Yeah, and younger people. I think this is an issue, is that we want to encourage people who are in parts of the country that are more economically depressed to be able to move to parts of the country where they have more opportunities. But the problem is housing is so expensive in those areas that we are potentially decreasing our amount of human capital in the country, or decreasing the value of that human capital because of some of our housing policies.
Yeah. So I guess I'd finish with this. Should housing be an asset for your typical family? Probably not. We'd be better off if it wasn't. Unfortunately, that's where we are, and probably always will be in America.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company, and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
And finally, because this is the guide to the business and finance news of the week, let's talk about your former classmate, Mr. Martin Shkreli.
I did not go, I was not his classmate. He was several years above me. He did date someone in my grade briefly. But
he just got sentenced to 7 years in prison.
He did.
And also this week, Elizabeth Holmes got dinged by the SEC and had to hand back $500,000 and promise not to be a director of a public company in the next 10 years. And long story short, didn't go to prison at all.
No.
And very unlikely to.
I don't know if it's 100%.
It's not 100%.
They're still outstanding.
It's still improbable. And
I agree with that.
The fact is that her fraud was $700 million. And that's the amount of money that she basically fraudulently obtained from investors, which they will never see back, compared to the size of Shkreli's fraud, which to a first approximation was zero. Like, his investors did get their money back.
So they did.
Is there some weird, what's going on here?
You know, I think what you're seeing is politics and publicity play a role in prosecutions. Right. Well, that's the bottom line. But there are a lot of things about the Shkreli case that make me a little bit sad. And I wrote about them last week. You know, the big thing before getting to Elizabeth Holmes and that comparison is just that I think symbolically it left a very sour taste in my mouth, because in the end he is going to jail for essentially lying to investors in his first couple of hedge funds about his prior performance and what the hedge funds were,
and then taking,
running a Ponzi scheme for a while.
There's that,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he it was small-time Wall Street crimes, right? This was not huge stuff. It was they were pretty obviously crimes, but it was not, it's kind of thing probably happens all the time and just never, we never hear about. And, eventually he managed to pay them back because he finally got into the business of buying old drugs and hiking their prices radically and then just earning lots of profits off that. And he managed to funnel cash back to the people who had staked him before through what prosecutors said were these sham consulting contracts. What's funny is that he didn't even get convicted on the sham consulting part, even though the company, his drug company was supposedly the victim here. Or one of the victims here. There was some stock scam, too, that was involved in all this. It was sort of nebulous. But, you know, in the end, he got convicted for screwing some investors, sort of, and was nothing he got in trouble for had anything to do with screwing patients or screwing the medical system or what everyone was actually angry about him for. And I just thought that really kind of spoke to the values that are embedded in our legal system.
Are you saying that he should have, in like a better society, we would put people in jail for hiking drug prices?
No, that like there's no. I'm not saying in a better society we would actually put him in jail for it necessarily. But that is, we think it's what he did is okay in the end, right? People will continue to do that. Like, just that is our legal system as is built, our regulatory and legal system. It's all kind of a piece says. Okay, yeah, you can corner the market on a drug. Like, that's what we have designed as society. However, we have made sure that you do not screw with investors. If you get caught doing that, you will go to jail. And necessarily...
But isn't Elizabeth Holmes a data point? If you really screw investors to the tune of $700 million, then you don't go to jail?
I kind of disagree. I don't think the difference between their sentencing is unfair. I actually think it makes sense. I think it makes sense both because partly I actually think Shkreli is going to prison for raising the drug prices.
I think that attracted attention to his case.
Well, and
that
also
possibly.
Obviously affected sentencing.
Yeah.
And I also think Shkreli is someone who is a repeat offender. He has been essentially running a con after a con after a con. He has also, when he was going through his trial...
He ran three cons, really.
And
that's con after con. Okay, you got three. Yeah, all right.
And when he was going through his trial, he was extremely...
He was a dick.
But
that's because Shkreli's a dick.
No, but I think that that's important because he, you know, he did that weird thing saying that he would give a $5,000 bounty for a piece of Hillary Clinton's hair. He was showing that if this guy doesn't go to jail, he's not reforming in any way. He enjoys the infamy. And that is completely different with Elizabeth Holmes. I think that she should be punished for what she did, but the intent was completely different in these two situations. Also,
what do you think?
Her intent was to make a lot of money.
I think. Well, I think her intent was clearly, and I'm not trying to defend Elizabeth Holmes but she clearly believed that and was probably somewhat delusional to believe that she could actually create this product. They thought that they would get there and that they were just buying time, which is still wrong. You are not allowed to do that. But I think that is different than Shkreli, who clearly was just trying to get rich and screw people.
Okay, so there's this Paul Kodrowski defense of Theranos, and he thinks that the punishment for Elizabeth Holmes is too big, and she shouldn't be punished even this much.
I missed that. What was the...
And his defense is basically, this is what all startups do. They all lie about their revenues.
Oh, yeah.
They all take a fake it till you make it approach. And if you criminalize that, then that's the end of all tech startups.
Oops. Yeah, I mean,
no, I mean, I think that
the problem with the model.
I agree. I mean, I think she is a victim of this Silicon Valley narrative. However, it's one thing when you're talking about this narrative with people who are like having a startup delivering groceries or something. But if you have a startup that's related to testing of people's blood related to illnesses, that's getting a little bit more serious.
Yeah. And yeah, there were human beings who were seriously harmed by Theranos. They went into Walgreens, they did blood tests, they got results which were very bad results, and they wound up having to go through procedures which they didn't need and all of this kind of stuff as a result of those blood tests. You don't give people blood test results when you don't know that that's the actual truth.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many issues that this case raises. I was reading through the SEC's complaint and just thinking about the fact that she tricked Walgreens the way she did was sort of, I mean, it tells you, like, they weren't able to do due diligence on this, that they fell for the scam. Just, I feel like that hasn't gotten enough attention. That, right? Like, the country's top pharmacy chain just sort of listened to this and believed her. But, you know, and another thing is just, you know, again, she's someone who got in trouble for screwing investors and is technically not getting in trouble for screwing patients. But in some ways, we rely on our securities laws as sort of a catch-all for corporate wrongdoing, that if you lie to people in general, and no matter what you're lying to, as long as you also lied to investors, then they can kind of get you for that too, right? Like, you know,
so this is actually a response. This is, I mean, I kind of like this as a sort of umbrella explanation of everything.
Yeah.
It answers Paul Kudrowski as well. Like, what you do is you say, Martin Shkreli is a dick who needs to go to jail. Elizabeth Holmes is a Silicon Valley founder who went way too far in terms of the lies that she told. And, you know, your random startup bro in Palo Alto with an app which fails is, you know, also theoretically guilty of defrauding investors, but we don't see any real harm in the startup row with an app, so we don't prosecute that person at all. We do see a certain amount of real harm in the Theranos case in terms of people going into Walgreens and getting bad results back, and so we do punish Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes for her sins. And we use the securities laws as a pretext. And when Martin Shkreli comes along and is just like cocking a snook at the entire country, we throw him away for 7 years. Again, we'll use the securities laws as an excuse, but that's not really what he's being jailed for.
Yeah, but what makes me uncomfortable with that is that in the end, the reason Martin Shkreli was able to cock a snook at the entire country was for something he did, an honest scam. Right? He didn't lie about what he was doing with Daraprim or any of the other drugs he pulled this with. It was totally on the table. He defended that on CNBC.
And that's a separate issue about whether or not we should have certain regulations on the drug industry.
Exactly. And so, you know, in a way, you just happen to get lucky with Shkreli that aside from being a dick, he was also a liar.
Not really that surprising. You often find that when people have these really, really awful business models, they tend to be a little bit creative in their accounting too.
Yeah, I guess I'm uncomfortable with the idea of relying on securities laws are sort of a catch-all. I'm sort of uncomfortable with that as well. And as far as Holmes goes, I am surprised actually that she's not, hasn't been prosecuted. I mean, her lies were on the same, as far as screwing investors go, her lies were definitely on the same magnitude as Shkreli's. Like,
losses were much greater.
Yeah, the losses were much, much larger. The severity of lies were arguably much greater. If she does not get prosecuted, I'm going to be left with the feeling that there's just, you know, she's a powerful friend still, and that's what's somehow protecting her, even though I don't know what connections they have to Washington. I don't understand why.
What good is served by her going to prison?
But what good was served by Martha Stewart going to prison?
I completely agree with you. I actually don't think Martin Shkreli should go to prison for 7 years. I think that we have a ridiculous system in this country where we put too many people in prison and we put them in prison for too long.
I think
Elizabeth Holmes is at this point, like, her, you know, her company's value is gone, which was all the money she essentially had. And she is not probably going to be able to start a company even post 10 years, because who's going to invest in her company?
Oh, I wouldn't put it past
it's it. Okay, that's possible. But I think that she's being punished pretty harshly. I don't really understand why going to prison is really going to do much more. Whereas with Shkreli, he seemed to enjoy like going through this process of, you know, going to court every day. I think it makes sense for him to go to prison for a short period of time in a way that I don't think it makes that much sense for her.
No.
You could disagree with me. And it's fine. It's just that it goes into the idea of, like, why do we send people to prison? What is the point of sending people to prison? If it's the point to stop other people from committing the crime, to punish people, to rehabilitate reduce recidivism.
I'm not all for Old Testament style justice all the time, but a modicum of it is sometimes good.
And I will add that my sort of big theory of white collar crime is that it's prosecuted so rarely that when you do find someone guilty, they really should go to prison, because otherwise it's no deterrent at all. Given that your chances of getting prosecuted is so low, you need a pretty high chance of going to prison in order to have any kind of deterrent effect there.
And I just want to add, for the sake of not libeling anyone, we do not know for sure that Elizabeth Holmes has, she's not been charged with a crime. We do not know if she'd be convicted with a crime. We do not know.
And she has not actually admitted that she's done it.
Yeah, exactly. That was all, she did not admit fault as part of the settlement. So, Elizabeth, we're not libeling you. We just think you should be in jail.
So let's finish this off with Jordan's final number.
I had one about trade, but no, I think my final number is going to be 4, which is the number of pours of wine I've had over the course of this episode. Felix, I still would like to try the Lebanon wine, but I will say the Colt Utah Grenache, white Grenache, is lovely, and I will probably be taking a picture of this bottle to go get myself one at some point later on. Do they have this at Astor Wines or something? Where can I get that?
You can get that at Chambers.
I can get that at Chambers? Okay, I'm going to go find that one.
Hang out here on this podcast, if you're a Slate Plus listener, to listen to the Jordan, Felix, and Anna review of The Low Road at the Public Theater. Thank you to everyone who came out to say hi to Jordan, to buy him a drink on Pi Day. Fun Pi Day. And on Slate Plus, we will talk about the play. If you're not a Slate Plus member, become a member. You can do that at slate.com/plus. Or go listen to Spoiler Specials instead, which is also a Dan Schrader production. It comes out every other week on Friday mornings, and it's hosted by a rotating cast of critics who all have one thing in common, which is that not only have they seen the films, but they are going to talk in detail about all of those spoilers, which the reviews don't mention because they're spoilers. So once you know that he was dead all along, then you can listen to Spoiler Specials. Other than that, keep the emails coming, slatemoney@slate.com. Do suggest other guests that we can have. We have an empty chair here now which needs filling. So give us some ideas for people who should sit in it. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.